Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. March 5, 2020. Cabinet published my new article, How to Respond to Questions About Death in the Coronavirus Era. As the coronavirus continues its world tour, and panic penetrates populations of people, some are facing the ultimate question about death. How should we respond to death? What is death? What happens after we die? The nature surrounding us is wise and great. We are birthed within, and develop in, nature. Many systems function on a moment-by-moment basis to sustain our bodies for 70, 80, and even 100-plus years. And part and parcel with our global-scale problems is a global awakening of life's deeper questions. But why? Are we supposed to just be born, live then die? We endure difficult and painful years between our births and deaths. How much pleasure do we actually squeeze out of them? We care for our bodies in a Sisyphean way, and we feel less and less energy to keep going. It is as if we're shifting from living and breathing organisms into a biodegradable stage, after which we completely disintegrate. Is there any benefit to such an existence? Or are we just supposed to struggle for years to make our way in life as best as we can until we eventually perish? Evaluating the purpose of life through four levels of nature. Each and every finest detail of nature holds benefit and continuity. There are three distinct levels in nature: still, vegetative and animate. The person, in his current developmental stage, belongs to the animate world. Humanity, however, differentiates itself as the speaking level, which is higher than the animate. What, then, makes humans different to animals? We are fundamentally a two-legged breathing mammal that fulfills its basic animal needs to eat, drink, sleep and reproduce. However, we have additional mental and emotional capacity, letting us absorb knowledge and wisdom. We raise children, pass knowledge from one generation to the next, and develop tools and our society with the aim of making us feel better and more comfortable. In other words, we have basic survival needs for food, shelter, sex and family, and then we have social needs where we compare ourselves to others, and we thus fence ourselves off from each other, clothing ourselves, housing ourselves and filling our houses and bodies with countless products that we advertise to each other. So are we just smart animals that have worked out how to make ourselves more comfortable in the world? The key difference between humans and animals. The key difference between humans and animals is that we humans have a deeper aspiration seeded within us that aspires beyond the boundaries of our temporary protein bodies. We also have the ability to pinpoint this aspiration. Like animals, we're afraid of death and want to live. But in addition to animals, only we humans ask about why we live. Not all humans ask about the meaning of life. Around a tenth of the adult population asks about the meaning of life, and all children ask about it, but soon forget. Therefore, the coronavirus, conflicts between different countries and factions, falls of markets, and fierce social division, the harm that societies sells to themselves spread like a disease throughout the body of humanity. And part and parcel with our global scale problems is a global awakening of life's deeper questions. The journey to the ultimate sensation of our common origin. I hope that people with such questions will seek their answers, disallowing the billions of materialistic influences to distract our journey to the sublime perception and sensation of our common origin, and learning and implementing the laws of that perfect reality on the way. By actively seeking to uncover the answers to our inquiries, like peeling layers of an onion, we delve deeper into the understanding of the need to connect positively to others. Through our positive connection, we enter reality's control room, balancing our attitude with nature's attitude of mutual love and bestowal in an interconnected and interdependent wholeness. When we reach such equivalence of form with nature, we become healthy and beneficial parts in the system of our existence, entering into direct contact with nature's fundamental quality, love and bestowal, and experiencing a new and perfect life, free of fears, mistakes and problems. Development of Egoism and the Method of Connection, Part 5. The Method Received at Mount Sinai. Question: the method that the people of Israel received at the foot of Mount Sinai was given to them on condition that they would become as one man with one heart. What is this? Answer: the condition as one man with one heart means to be in our connection as similar as possible to one common, unified upper force and to feel that we are unable to do this ourselves. When we invest a certain amount of effort into connecting, we develop a strong desire to become similar to this force. Such an aspiration to a state where we together want to become as one common whole awakens the upper light. The upper light affects the person or people who awakened it, and it performs certain spiritual actions upon them. That is, it gives them the strength to connect, to rise above their egoism. Question: what was new in this method that Abraham did not have? Answer: firstly, egoism changed. If egoism is bigger, not in quantity but in quality, then, of course, a different method and other actions are required. The new egoism requires new means in order to rise above it, to start working with it, and to connect with each other precisely because of it, despite the fact that it separates people. Therefore, this method is called the method of connection. The force that we need to apply in order to connect is called the upper light or the Torah. From Cab TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, July 1, 2019. Michael Leitman, on Quora: is the esoteric Kabbalah even approaching legitimacy? Kabbalah is not a form of esotericism. People want to label Kabbalah as esoteric or mystic, and connect it with blessings, curses, charms, and many other phenomena. These labels became linked with Kabbalah because there was a prohibition on the study of Kabbalah in the masses for 1s of years since humanity's spiritual desire still hadn't ripened. In the 16th century, when the Ari, Kabbalist Isaac Luria, lifted the prohibition on the study of the wisdom of Kabbalah, claiming that the time had come for Kabbalah to be revealed to humanity, he also mentioned the prohibition on the use of charms and blessings, since they have nothing to do with Kabbalah. Kabbalah is a science that teaches the law of reality, of which we are a part. Through this science, we discover those rules and the spiritual world, which is the reason for everything that happens here with us. They are collective rules, which encompass the laws of all the sciences in our world. Kabbalah is not another belief or an imaginary view of life. Instead, it offers precise and clear laws that depict the structure of the upper worlds. It is when we study Kabbalah that we first acquire knowledge of the world outside our own. We discover the higher, spiritual world, and then we gradually attain the ability to affect it. Through tests and experiments, we learn how to do it, and then we enter the comprehensive reality. At this point, we begin to work not from within our own bodies, but from our souls, which are our true essence. The human being is not the physical body that is replaced at the beginning of each new life. The human being is the soul that we currently do not sense. The purpose of creation is that we will act from within our souls, from the upper world, and live at the highest degree possible, rather than in the lowest, our world, which is at an animal level. By discovering our souls, we attain contact with the upper world, and thus achieve a whole, complete, eternal and blissful life. Our world is a black dot. Question: you say that our world doesn't exist. In what sense does it not exist and why? What does illusory mean, and whose illusion it is? Answer: it is our illusion. In reality, our world does not exist. What does in reality mean? In the property of bestowal, which is the only thing that exists in reality, Our world does not exist. Our world is the property of reception, it is pure egoism. And the world itself does not exist, it is purposefully created as a ghostly and illusory one so that we live in it as at the starting point of our true spiritual development, so that we exist outside of the spiritual worlds, outside of true existence. Our world is simply a black dot. From Cab TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, January 5, 2020. New Life Number 1200. Communication in Relationships.
Hello, and thanks for being with us on the New Life Show with Dr. Michael Lightman. Hello, Dr. Lightman. Hello, everyone. Hello, Tal Mandelbaum. Hello. And today we'd like to talk a bit about interpersonal communication. We live our life around us. There are other people. It could be at work, at home, in other places. And nowadays, communication isn't doing that great. There are many frictions, eruptions, and so on. We'd like to learn how to do it a bit better. Be with us, Tal, please. Yeah, today I'd like for us to focus on communication within relationships. I heard this claim that the main reason it doesn't work is because there's this approach that there's someone who's right and someone who's wrong. And then in our relationship, we all the time try to show the other person that they're wrong and I'm right. And this impairs our ability to reach a good and empathic kind of communication. If something bothered me about our relationship and I'll tell someone else, what you did was wrong, you hurt me, and so on, most chances are that the answer that I'll get won't be one of acceptance, of sympathy, but to the contrary, it will create a conflict that the other person will say that you're wrong, and so on, and so forth. So today we'd like to understand how to build a correct kind of communication within our relationships. So the first question is, do you agree that as an assumption that behind every negative behavior of any person, there is an unfulfilled desire or need, an unmet desire or need, that this is why they behave the way that they do? Yes, but there is a reason that's even prior to that, that man is an egoist. And he has to prove to himself all the time that he's right. And the lack of satisfaction to feel that he's right, that he feels, that he's appreciated, this feeling is something that exists in him all the time in a more revealed or in a more concealed way. And sometimes he's really helpless, that he can't justify his existence. What am I living for? I'm not appreciated. No one's keeping me, supporting me. I'm not treated the way I deserve to be treated. And this is where the problem is. Sometimes I see this in relationships that even if I heard the slightest, tiniest criticism or something that upsets me, immediately it affects the entire relationship. I no longer appreciate anything and so on. Why? The tiniest thing can destroy everything. It's forbidden for us to turn to any person in a way that we accuse them of something, that we put that person down, that we show him that he's inferior. But we always have to elevate that person. I want for that person to change for the better. I elevate him to such a degree that he'll be afraid to come down from there. And by that, I correct him. I elevate him to such a degree that he's afraid to come down from there. He'll want to remain there and be even more and more, see how great I am. And let him think that. The main thing is that he'll behave accordingly. It's really an entire inner revolution for a person. Yeah? And then, by that, I can correct criminals and such people that never thought about behaving properly, suddenly they start feeling how I'm being treated, what people think about me, how everyone respects me. I feel that I'm like a king. And then that person will do everything that he can to stay that way and become even more. I want to give an example from life. Many times in the generation gap, we see young parents bring their children to their grandparents, and the grandparents, they have these habits from the past, like giving candy, sugar, and so on. And when the parents tell the grandparents the way you behave with the children isn't the way we do, then, you know, there are different explosions, conflicts, I raised you and you turned out fine, and so on and so forth. It's an example where communication can bring a solution that's good for everyone. What communication? You have to have education here. If I come to my mom with my children, this is how it really was for years, then really, my children and even my grandchildren, when they used to come to grandma, they got different sweets and everything there is, in short, many things. And I only used to say, look how much grandma loves you and this and that, even though that really these things aren't that good. And even though that she's a doctor and she always made sure that everyone's fit and healthy, but in this regard, she was weak. Yeah, grandmas have this instinct that they have to give candy. Can't you do anything about it? Can't you talk to a person and ask, please change something in what you're doing? No. I also want to give her an opportunity to be happy that she can give them something. What can you do? But it spoils the children. They won't be spoiled because of that. That they come once every few weeks or even once a week to grandma and get 100 or 200 grams of candy. In my case, it could be more than once a week. We live close to each other. And so maybe in this case you can say, but still, that it's not because of you, but that you took the children to the doctor or the dentist, and this is what he said, and so on. Meaning that it's not up to you, but it's up to some foreign factor. Grandma can get mad at the doctor, no problem. It's really frustrating that you can't ask for something. No, you can't. Love, in this regard, is blind. What do you mean? Because I love giving candy to whomever I love. But it's not healthy. Why didn't you give him instead of that a piece of meat or something? Or some vegetable. It's healthier. Some cabbage. Well, it's just one example, but there are many such examples. With toys, it's even worse. There, it's already an ideological matter. What do I, what don't I give, and so on. So you can't come to a person that thinks something and ask him to behave differently? No, you have to relate it to some foreign factor. What is it about the connection that doesn't allow it? It's a person's pride or what? You're not allowing the grandma to open her heart to her grandchildren. This is severe. Very severe. From that point on, she will not forgive you. I'm telling you seriously. She will not forgive you for it ever. It's not up to her. This is how it is, rooted in nature. This is specifically in regard to grandparents and their grandchildren, but even if I'll come up to my husband and I'll tell him that he's doing something wrong and so on, it could cause a conflict. Meaning there's something about the communication itself that doesn't work. True. What principle do we have to learn here? The principle is that you never tell a person that he is to blame, at fault, that he's wrong, that he's incomplete. But if he is wrong, if he is at fault, obviously he's at fault and he's wrong. But how to say it, how to correct it, then not in the way that you're presenting it. How then? You have to reach a state where It's good if you hear that he made some kind of mistake, but not in relation to you. And then he's looking for some kind of advice as to how to get out of that situation. And then you can intervene and speak your mind, because in that you're helping him. You're not saying anything against him. And also that you're telling him now how to behave, you're saying, I saw in some place, or I learned in this and that course that this is the way to do it, look what they explained. Not me, but it seems to me that it suits your case. To get myself as little as possible into this, because otherwise what? It creates a struggle of forces. Yeah, because I position myself against grandma. But no, this is what the doctor said. The dentist said that it's critical, otherwise we'll have to do surgery. So if the child has an allergy or something, then it's clear. It's hard to accept it, because if you know that this is a mistake, this is wrong, and still you want to do something, you can't say anything. You can say anything, but only in a way that it will be accepted. So on another show, we said that in order to bring a person to the place where you want them to be, you have to prepare them. Yeah, you have to plan these things too. So how can I be smarter? How can I prepare in order to bring the grandmother or whoever to the place I want them to be? So much that you talk to the dentist or the pediatrician, and you take your child there, and the doctor explains that it's forbidden to eat candy or something and so on. And then, when you're at grandma's, then you ask, sweetie, you remember we went to the doctor's? Yeah. And what did he say? And she herself says, grandma, and that's that. So, if we're already mentioning children, then in the relationships between parents and children, there's an entire theory that talks about how to talk to them so it will be empathic communication. Many times the children, they cry, they're sad, and the instinct, at least in previous generations, was to say, don't worry, everything's fine. Meaning to stop that child's emotion, saying that what you're feeling now, you shouldn't be feeling. You shouldn't be angry. You shouldn't be sad. And there's an approach today that says, no, that you actually have to identify with the child. That was hard. It hurt you. A child has to see that you're identifying with them, that you love them regardless of or above all of these things, no matter what happens. First of all, love. Even if he's wrong, and you bet he's wrong, and I told him so, and that he'll suffer as a result, and he didn't listen to me, and he suffered, and he got blows and everything. In this, I want to show him that I'm with him, that you're suffering with him, that you're identifying with his pain, and so on. Yeah, it's not simple. I know this about myself. That even though that you're doing everything good and for his sake and so on, still you want to put in some moral. Told you so. Right. But no. To only show love. Okay, it's not simple. But this way, you're sure that the same way you treat him, the same way you care for him, he will care for your grandchildren. That's how he'll treat them. And even your grand-grandchildren, when you won't be around anymore, it'll pass on to your offsprings. I just wanted to add that today, adults can say about themselves that because their parents told them that they don't have to cry, that everything's fine, they stopped identifying with their own emotions. They stopped understanding, feeling what they themselves feel, as if disregard what they feel, and only listen to what other people tell them they should feel. Is it correct that as a parent we should make room for a child's emotions so that he'll learn how to identify his own emotions and make room for them? I wouldn't say that a child has to hold himself back. What do you mean? He feels like crying, he should. He feels like shouting, he should. Let him burst out, go wild, according to his inner urges. What's the significance of a person being able to feel his own emotions without blurring them? Then he better knows who he is, and not that someone stopped him, and he stops himself, and so on, and he buries these feelings inside, and it doesn't allow him to keep developing, because to the measure to which he closes himself, he can't develop. Why? These are two contradicting things. So suppose now the child's angry at us, at the parents, and the egoistic instinct of a parent is to be mad back at them. Don't shout at me, this, that. What should be the correct approach toward an angry child in order to neutralize it in the correct way? To accept this anger, that it's present, okay, but I relate to it calmly. He can be angry, he can shout, he can say mom and dad are bad, and whatever he thinks. But that he integrates with his emotions, that I don't stop that. And that when he behaves the way he does, that he will see that my attitude toward him is calm, normal, like toward everyone. And he's like, and I'm calm, like toward everyone else. And then he'll start asking what's going on here. And this will make him change. What will he understand? He will understand that maybe he's doing something wrong in this behavior, that my behavior, it doesn't matter what are we talking about here, but that my behavior is more respectable. So he'll want to behave more like you. Yeah. And what if I get mad back at him? So what am I showing him then? That it's okay just to be in confrontation, to shout at each other, to fight. I don't want to give him this kind of example. Would it be true to say that behind a child's negative behavior, when he goes wild or treats others unfavorably, there is some unsatisfied desire, and I have to find what causes him to behave negatively, and if I find what that thing is and I meet his needs indirectly, I've solved the problem? Yes. Aside from special cases where children really go crazy and you have to shake them a bit or even give them a little slap in order to stop this outburst. But here we're already talking about a medical condition. So my ability to identify something more inner, some need that exists in a person, and to meet that need instead of directly trying to stop that behavior, yes, that he'll learn from it himself. And even if it's a grown-up that's mad at me, maybe he says different things, I don't even hear what he's saying, I only understand that he's lacking something on the inside, and if I give him love and all the things that we talked about, this will help him overcome his anger. Yeah, tell him, I think that you're right. Why does a person have to hear that? If he'll hear that, for him it's the biggest blow. Because he's expecting some kind of response. He wants to continue. And suddenly you neutralize all of his weapons. How to correctly behave with another person that's angry at me or I'm angry at them, to agree with them? I think that you're right. I'm even worse than what you're saying. That's terrible to hear that. This is a very serious blow to hear something like that. Yeah, it is. So what do we have to do about ourselves in order to be able to reach the state where we tell someone else that they're right? Because mostly we don't have the ability to do that. We have to justify ourselves. Well, if it doesn't have to do with my work or something, that it's about the direction, the goal, everything else, About what we talked before, we said that a child always has to feel that I love him above everything. I wrote it down as a principle, that I love him no matter what. And also you said that it's not always easy, because sometimes I see that he's wrong and so on, but still, I love him. Sometimes there could be such states where children use these states, these situations. Meaning what? How do I, as a parent, find the boundary between expressing infinite love and certain boundaries without which the child will fall apart and it will harm him? That's a big problem. How do I, as a parent, find what's right between these two extremes? Love is good if it is within limitations, within boundaries. Otherwise, it isn't. In order to love, you have to have a heart of stone. Meaning what? Softness has to come with inner hardness. That it's measured, controlled, under control. Of course. And then I present myself outwards as someone soft and loving, but on the inside I keep the boundaries and I don't allow for them to be breached. A bit more about how to do it. Up until now we talked about that a child always has to feel the confidence that at home he's always loved. That he always has to feel at home, that no matter what I did, I failed, I did something, whatever. This is where I'm loved, and there is room for me to find all those emotions that surface in me and to evolve from here, not to suppress. What does it mean to evolve? That I, as a child, do the math. That I'm really allowed to do, and I have the confidence to be as a free and open. But still, how, from this point on, every time do I calibrate myself to behave correctly? What gives a child the understanding of how to behave correctly if you only show him love and acceptance, no matter what he does? We have to show it to him that our love also isn't limitless or unbounded, but it's on condition. We support him on condition that he learns from it. Otherwise, no. And here we have to really keep the boundary. So if my child's wrong, he did something even though that I said don't do it, that if you don't put on a shirt you'll catch a cold, and he did, so I don't come and say because he didn't listen to me now you have a cold, but I'm empathic to how he feels and so on. But how will I make it so that next time he'll listen to me? Next time you can tell him, you remember, you didn't listen last time and what happened. Yeah, exactly. And these things, it's better for children. In the past, this is how it was common, to write a diary, to learn from our mistakes. Yeah? And then, when he writes it himself, then let's see, 3-4 weeks ago, what happened to us. Good idea for us grown-ups too. So, one more thing I read about and wanted to ask. Do we have to get rid of being judgmental in relation to the emotions and responses of the other? An important thing about empathic communication is that you respect the other person as they are. You're not judgmental. You don't show that you're like better. How important is equality between two people in order for them to be able to come closer in their relationship and so on? If we're talking about two adults, then Here we already have to think. Here it's a much more complicated relationship. There's no dependence here. Or there is, but we have to see what kind of dependence do we have here. Is there or isn't there love and so on? Meaning, depends who are we talking about. We have to see exactly what are we talking about and then. Suppose our spouse. When my spouse responds in a certain way, I'm immediately judgmental. He doesn't have to think that way, feel that way, and then it pushes away. No, that will never work. Only in concessions. Meaning what? That I accept the other as they are without wanting to change them, but I change myself. I adapt myself to them. Why? Because otherwise it won't work. But there are things in that you will feel that you're gaining, actually. But sometimes, in general, I understand what you're saying. But sometimes there could be things in your spouse that you have to change. So, after you reach some kind of happy middle, a good relationship, take an hour and talk about it. Talk about it, please, no problem. But it should be agreed upon that this is what you do. And also, never to bring it to a fight. Don't think that after the fight, we're going back to something good. It never comes back to anything good. So, where should we stop? What boundary shouldn't we breach? We agree with one another that we can stop our fight with a kiss. That's it. Everyone is allowed to kiss the other, and there we stop. So, what I understand from today's show is that to directly turn to a person with my opinion, my desire, with what I feel, and so on, it'll never work. There always has to be some kind of a concession about what I feel, want, and so on, in order to turn to the other person in a way that it'll encourage him and he'll be willing to hear. Yes, and the other person can't refuse. This is the only thing that we ask of the other person. And should the work be mutual? Of course. If one of them says, that's it, I can't take this anymore, I'm going to kiss you. The other person can't refuse. Should the other person also make concessions towards me? This means that he's making concessions, that he comes and kisses. But if he's still accusing me of something, no, we're through with the accusations. We're finished with that scrutiny. We can say, in 2 or 3 days, we're going to talk about it. In 2 or 3 days, when everything's good, nice, soft, we decided that now we're going to talk about this, let's talk. Like in basketball. Time out. Dr. Lightman, last question. When a person concedes, you said that concessions are the key to nonviolent empathic communication. Yes. What do I concede? My pride. That's it. Some rubbish, some inflated balloon in my stomach. That's it. Were we able to do it, the world would have been a better place. Thank you very much, dear friends. Thank you, Dr. Lightman. Thank you, Todd. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.